Good morning and Christian greetings to each of you this morning. It is a pleasure to gather in and worship the glorified Christ together. We don't always think about Christ and his glory. It was good to look at that this morning in our Sunday school lesson. And welcome each one of you to our service. Welcome the home folks and the visitors as well. Trust that as we go through, continue in the service that we can glorify Christ, continue to lift him up this morning. There was a verse in Daniel that I thought of as we got near the end of our lesson. We were talking about Christ's glory and the look that John saw there as Christ was revealed to him. Daniel 12, verse 3 says, "And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." And so I think we too can look forward to shining. I don't think we'll shine as brightly as Christ, but I believe that in the future we can shine and will shine as well as we live a righteous life and as we live for him. So I was going throughout this week, especially toward the end of the week, I was thinking about what to share this morning and what to bring, and I wasn't sure what I should preach on. It didn't seem to be real clear, and as I was just thinking over some of my thoughts of different things throughout the week, I started thinking about the subject of leadership more, and I was thinking over that a bit, and I thought, you know, what is leadership? And if I say this morning that I'm going to preach a sermon on leadership, does that mean that most of you will kind of sit back and shut down and say, well, that's not really for me because I don't think I'm in leadership or I don't think I'm a leader? You know, what is leadership? Who is a leader? Would it only relate to the adult men here this morning, as, you know, hopefully they at least are leaders in their homes or where their sphere of responsibility is? Or would it only relate to the ordained men that are sitting here on the front couple of benches? Is that who we would think of when we think of leadership? Think of leadership at church. Is the leaders at church, is that primarily for those who have been called to be leaders? Some of what had my mind rolling was a comment or a statement that Brother Allen made in Sunday school class last week, and I think I have it correctly, at least the thought anyway. He said this: not all leaders in a congregation are ordained. Not all leaders in a congregation are ordained. And I was thinking about that. What did he mean, and what was he saying? And he went on to illustrate a bit by thinking about his experience in the classroom. And you have a teacher in the classroom. Of course, the teacher is to be the leader, but there's also some other leaders in the classroom, and it depends a lot on the dynamics of the class and maybe the age of the children. But I think, you know, as you reflect on that, you can understand that there's, yes, the teacher is to be the leader, but you also have some other dynamics there of other people that are providing some sort of leadership in that classroom, and that is, you know, one or more of the students. So when you think about that statement, you know, what was he implying? What was he saying, that not all leaders in a congregation are ordained? Was he simply stating that within our congregation there are leaders in other spheres of responsibility? You are a leader in your home, or maybe you're a leader in the classroom, leader in school. Maybe you're a leader in business. Maybe you're a leader on a board or a committee or on some volunteer project, and you're a leader in that sphere. Is that what he was saying when he was saying not all leaders are ordained? Is that what he is referring to? Well, as I thought more about leadership, I do plan to talk a little bit about leadership, but a bit more, not as focused on that as such this morning. I'm just going to write leadership up here on the board to begin with. We're going to think about leadership a little bit as we go throughout the sermon this morning. I'd also like to think about another word. I'm going to write that one here on the board as well. And that is the word influence. Talk about leadership and influence. And that is the title of my sermon this morning, Leadership and Influence. And you could say a leader and an influencer. Influencer is kind of a modern word in our day and age in which we live in, an influencer. Now, John Maxwell, who writes largely on business and leadership, he said this: leadership is influence. Nothing more, nothing less. And that's one aspect of it. I don't know if that says it in its entirety, but there's a lot of influence that goes along with leadership. And so if we say that leadership is influence, can you say it the other way around, and that is that influence is leadership? Well, there's aspects of it, and we'll see that as we go along. It may or may not be good leadership, but it could be leadership. And I think when that statement that was made in Sunday school class, I think Alan was recognizing, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but recognizing that influence makes a person a leader without regard to their position. Influence makes a person a leader without regard to their position. And we'll get to the fact that maybe we'll get to the point of whether it's good or bad, but there's some truth to that. And so we could ask the question again, are you a leader? I have another question for you to consider this morning. Do you influence others? Do you influence others? Because there's a real sense in which your influence will lead that person in a particular path if they are following you. If they are following your influence, does that not make you a leader if you have followers? They say if you're a leader with no followers, then you're not a leader. If you have followers, then you must be a leader. And also, think about, who am I following? Who are you following? Who is my leader? Who are your leaders? Who is influencing me? In Jude's time, that was our Sunday school lesson last Sunday, in Jude's time, there were certain men crept in unawares. I believe that was where that statement came in. We were looking at that verse where there were certain men that had come into the church, and he says unawares. Now, do you believe those men came in that they didn't see them sitting there? Were they men that were not very visible? Did they just slink in and nobody noticed they were there? You know, I don't think that was the case. I think they were people there that everybody knew they were there. It was not unknown to them. They knew they were in the church just like everybody else. They were there. But I believe what he was referring to was their intentions that were maybe undercover or covert and not easily seen. But yet they were there, and they were influencing the church in the wrong direction. Influence can be both positive and negative. And so we don't want to just say that an influence. I hope you are influencing other people. I we need to be influencers. But there's positive and there's negative influences. Proverbs 27, verse 17 says, iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. So there's a positive influence. Positive influence you can have on another person. But conversely, 1 Corinthians 15, 33 says, be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners. And so we know that that's what happens. When you put bad company, it will ruin good morals. They corrupts good manners. As I thought more about this idea and this thought about leadership and influence and how the two go together, how they interact, I thought about the story of the children of Israel, and I'm not going to read it, at least not much of it this morning, but I do want to tell it to you, and hopefully we can learn something from this story. The story is familiar probably to all of us, most of us at least. The children of Israel coming out of Egypt, being delivered from Egypt, and they were on this journey, this exodus through the wilderness. Think about the leadership of the children of Israel. There were two men in particular that provided leadership. There was Moses. Moses was a servant of God. So I'm just going to write his name up under leadership here. We have Moses. And it says that Moses was more than a prophet. God himself said that a prophet is revealed. God reveals his message to a prophet through dreams, through visions, those types of things. But he says, not so with Moses. With Moses, I speak to him directly, just like a man, just like two men speak. And they have a conversation. That's how God interacted with Moses. He received a message with direct conversation with God. And then you also had Aaron. Aaron was, we know, the spokesperson for much of Moses' interaction with Pharaoh and maybe also with the people of Israel. Some, but often when you go through the story, you see it says Moses and Aaron this. Moses and Aaron. God commanded Moses and Aaron. And Moses and Aaron said to the people, you have these two working together as a team, but I believe Moses was the man that God called as the primary leader. These men were instrumental to in the survival of the Israelites. And through the direction and help of God, they provided for this immense group. This group could have been in the millions. I think somewhere it says there were 600,000 footmen. So if you take that number and add some women and children to it, there could, I think sources say, anywhere from 1.2 to 5 million possibly. A big group of people. But they were provided for in the wilderness. And God used these men to lead them, to give them direction. You also have some other men listed in their experience. You have Joshua, who is known as Moses' assistant. In Exodus 24, it says, and Moses rose up and his minister Joshua, and they went up to the Mount of God. That was at Mount Sinai. And so you have Joshua as well providing some leadership for these people. There was also another group, I think it's in Numbers 10 or so, that Moses was feeling very burdensome and wearied by the responsibility. The people were complaining again. They were tired of this journey. And so God said to appoint 70 elders. And so there were 70 elders that provided some direction and leadership to this group of people as well. These are the leaders. And as they, you know, Moses had the primary responsibility. Aaron was right there, second in command, you could say. Joshua assisted them. And then you have these 70 elders who were spread out among the people just to provide some more direction. So think about who the leaders were in their experience. And then let's look at the story. So just to get a little bit of background, the story that we're going to look at is found mostly in Numbers 13 and 14. But just to get a little background, we know that they came out of Egypt, it says, with a high hand. So they were feeling good. They were delivered from slavery. They were excited. This was great. This was an adventure. And they came out of the oppressions of Egypt. As we know, the journey had its ups and downs. And it wasn't long until they found themselves trapped at the Red Sea because Pharaoh's army was coming behind them. The Red Sea was in front of them. They didn't know where they were going to go. What were they going to do? Here they were, brought out in the wilderness to be killed by the Egyptians. And God miraculously parted the waters, and they walked through on dry ground. And the Israelites made it through, and we know that the Egyptians did not make it through. And God calls the waters to come back again over the Egyptians, and he destroyed the army of the Egyptians through drowning. Well, they journeyed on into the wilderness with God meeting their needs in miraculous ways. And when they got to Mount Sinai, they camped there for almost a whole year. And there, God gave the law to Moses. And you know how Moses went up in the mountain, got the Ten Commandments, as well as other parts of the law. And also while they were there, they constructed the first tabernacle according to God's plan and God's direction. And so you had this happening at Mount Sinai, and now you're about a year or so out of the deliverance from Egypt. From there, they moved on and camped in various places. But throughout their journey, time and time again, they complained about the difficulties. And that's normal human nature, normal tendency. They complained about the lack of variety in their diet. They complained about the difficulties of the journey. They complained, Aaron and Miriam even complained about Moses as being a leader and you know, who made you more important than anybody else? Well, at that time, God, in no uncertain terms, confirmed that Moses is the man that he had chosen to lead the people of Israel. And he made it very clear that Moses was the man, and he told them how he talks to Moses like a man talks to a man. And he made it very plain that this was who he was chosen to lead this group of people. Well, then they arrive at Kadesh, and this is where the story I like to pull from begins. They arrived at Kadesh, and there Moses chose 12 men, one from each tribe, to scout out the land of Canaan. And God told Moses to pick out rulers in the tribe, so it seems these men had some level of responsibility, some level of leadership, at least within their tribe. And so you could maybe put them on the leadership side, you know, possibly, certainly not as important as Moses and Aaron, and probably not as important as Joshua, even though Joshua was one of these men, but they certainly had some responsibility. They were not just men that you didn't know. They were people that they knew. So they picked out these 12 men, and the one from the one tribe, there was Shammua, and there was Shaphat, there was Caleb, there was Igal, Joshua, Paltai, Gedael, Gadai, Amiel, Sether, Nabai, and Jeuel. So these 12 men. Now, of that list of names that I gave, there's probably only two that you remember, and that's for good reason. That was Caleb and Joshua, and we'll get to that later. But Moses told this group of men to go and search out the land. Go into the land of Canaan and check it out. Check out the land. Check out the condition of the soil. Check to see if the crops grow good. And check to see if there's some wooded areas. And check to see, you know, what the people are like. Look at their cities. See if the people are strong. And see where they dwell, where they dwell in cities. And take a look at what they, you know, how they live. Do they live in tents, or are they secured in their cities? And then he says, and you know, by the way, feel free to just take some of the fruit that you find there. Go ahead and you find some good fruit. Go ahead and take some of it and bring it back for us. And we'd like to see what is there. Go and we say spy out the land. They were called spies. They were scouts. Just go ahead of us and see what this land looks like. We are here on the cusp of entering Canaan, and let's go check it out and see what it's like. Well, these men left on their mission, and they were gone for 40 days. They traversed the land, checking it out, looked at the low country, looked at the high country, and looked at the cities, looked at the people. They covered various areas to get a feel for the land. They ran into various things. At Hebron, they found three men who were powerful sons of Anak, and they noted that. It was of interest. It was of note. It was noteworthy, these men. They were apparently bigger and more powerful than many people. Also in the Valley of Eshcol, they found some fresh fruit in season. It was the first ripe grapes. And it says that they cut a cluster of grapes, and they cut a branch with one cluster of grapes on it, and they took a pole, they took a staff, and they held it between two men, and they tied that group of that cluster of grapes to it so that these men could carry this cluster, transport it back to the camp of the children of Israel. They also found some pomegranates and figs. Well, at the end of 40 days, they returned to Moses and Aaron and the rest of the camp there at Kadesh. And they gave them a report of their findings. They showed them the fruit that they had found. They showed them the grapes and the pomegranates, the figs that they had brought back. They talked about the land, and they said, it's a wonderful place. It's a lovely place. And just look at this fruit that we brought back. This fruit is just wonderful. It is great. They said, this is a land that is flowing with milk and honey. That was their conclusion. A beautiful land flowing with milk and honey. But they said there's also some challenges there. There's challenges that we'll have to overcome if we're going to go in. The people are strong. The cities are big and secured with walls. And on top of all that, we saw some giants there. We saw some giants in the land. He went on to tell them that the Amalekites dwell in the south, the Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the hills, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan River. And so there was people there. There were people that they would need to conquer. Now, I would assume that as this group of people had come out, they may have been about 2 years, I'm not sure, out of Canaan, or out of Egypt, that there was some excitement as they neared Canaan. There was just like a ship that leaves Europe and sails across the ocean, and as they near land and as they catch sight of land, it provides some excitement. So I would think this group was quite excited about going into this new land. And I believe they were quite excited to hear this report that came back from the spies. But somewhere along the line, some excitement diminished just a bit, and they begin to, a murmur of unrest goes through the crowd and through the group as they listen to the report. And this unrest begins to stir some worry and fear. And no longer were they excited about going in and conquering the land of Canaan. Well, one of the men, Caleb, sensed what was happening, and he quiets all the people down, and he says to them, there's no reason that we can't do this. Let's go right away. Let's go and take possession. This is why we're here. This is what we came for. This is what we were waiting for. And we can certainly do this. There is no reason we can't do this. Let's go. Let's go and overcome it. This is ours to take. Well, there was 10 others who were along with that expedition. They said, no, that's not going to work. We can't conquer the land. The people are stronger than us. And they continued to spread their bad report about the land. They said the land devours the inhabitants, those that live there. And they said, all the people are giants. They are tough. They are bullies. We felt like grasshoppers. We felt like nothing. We felt like they could just step on us and extinguish our lives. And not only did we feel like that, we felt like we were grasshoppers, but they even looked at us and felt like we're grasshoppers as well. That was what they thought of when they looked at us. Don't ask me how they knew that. I don't think they asked them, but that's what they said. And in that whole change from excitement about going in to fear and worry and murmuring, that the whole community, it says, began to cry in despair. And their despair turned to anger, and they began to grumble and complain. They blamed Moses and Aaron for their situation and considered leading a rebellion and return to Egypt. Well, this was quite disheartening for Moses and Aaron, and in dismay, they fell on their faces to the ground before the community. They didn't know what to do with this group of people that had turned from excitement to grumbling and anger and rebellion. And Joshua and Caleb, the two spies that did not agree with the other 10, they tried once more to persuade the people to move ahead with the conquest. And they said once again that the land is good. They said, and if God's favor is on us, there's no reason that he won't give it to us. And there's no reason that he won't lead us forward and that we can't go in and conquer the land. The Lord is with us. Don't be afraid. They don't stand a chance. They don't stand a chance against us if God is with us. Well, at this point, the congregation was no longer willing to listen to anyone who opposed their conclusion. And in resistance, they threatened to stone Joshua and Caleb. Well, we know that God was provoked by their lack of faith. And he told Moses that he is ready to wipe them out. He said he could send a pestilence into the group and they could be wiped out. And then I could raise up another nation out of Moses that is mightier and stronger than the current nation of Israel. But Moses once again interceded for the people. And he asked God to be long-suffering and to be merciful and to pardon them and to forgive them for what they did and to show his great mercy. And at Moses' pleading, God pardoned the Israelites. However, there were still consequences for their action. Instead of entering the promised land of Canaan and the rest that had been promised to them, God sent them back into the wilderness to roam for another 40 years. 1 year for each of the 40 days they had been spying the land. Everyone who was 20 years and older at the time would die in the wilderness, except for Joshua and Caleb, the two that believed that God would give them the land of Canaan despite the challenges. Now, as we think about that story, there's just a couple of lessons that I think we can learn from this story. And so we have the leadership, as I already pointed out. Over here under influence, I'm going to put 10 spies. Now, as you think about this story, who do you think the children of Israel should have been listening to? Who should have they been influenced by? Well, I think the answer is very clear. They had a leader that spoke directly with God. They had Moses who had communication with God. You know, it should be very clear there's no reason they shouldn't have listened to Moses and to Aaron and to Joshua, the men that were the men that were there, that were providing leadership to the whole group. But you had these influencers, you had the 10 spies come along. They were also part of the group. So what can we learn from this? I have three different points that I'd like to think about. And I was trying to understand how to word these exactly, correctly. The first point is that human reasoning can be more influential than godly leaders. And I wasn't sure how to say it exactly because I thought about saying that it can be more influential than God's word. Okay, that sounds a little better to us because we know that God's word is infallible. God's word is secure. God's word is what we're going to be judged by. However, as we look at this story and look at what happened, God's word was coming through the leaders that God had put in place, okay? And so I decide to stick with the words godly leaders. I understand that men can fail. Men are fallible, and it does happen sometimes. But godly leaders who are in touch with God, just like Moses was in touch with God. I know we don't have direct communication, but I'd like us to think about the way that God has planned for to use men in his kingdom and in his work. And so human reasoning can be more influential than godly leaders. So we're just going to write human reasoning over here just so you can remember what these points are. Now, these spies use some human reasoning. Human reasoning often makes sense because we're humans, and so reasoning that we come up with makes sense to us, right? Our human tendency is to align with human reasoning. It's logical. It makes sense, especially for some of us that are more logical than others. If you can explain it with logic, it's got to be right, right? Human reasoning usually has arguments and facts to back it up. They did that in this case. They said the people in Canaan are strong. That was true. They said the cities are great. They have walls to protect them. Check. True as well. There were some tough men there. Maybe some big men. I don't know how big these sons of Anak were, but they were fearful. They were to be feared. And they in turn feared no one. True indeed. So they had some facts. And when you take that set of facts and you lay it and you take some human reasoning and put that in there, you say, you know what? You know what, we can't go in and we can't conquer the land because, well, just look at the facts. It won't work. It doesn't play out. And that's exactly what happened here. They took that human reasoning and said, but they forgot about God, you know. And so human reasoning became more influential, where while Moses and Aaron and Joshua should have been influencing the group, the 10 spies became influencers, and with human reasoning, they influenced the group away from God's plan and God's purpose. These men that had gone, well, all 12 of them, had experience. They had perspective that the others did not have. None of the rest of the group had been to Canaan. None of the rest had seen the walled cities. None of the rest had seen the giants. None of them had seen the strong people. So they had some perspective, and they had some experience. And shouldn't that count for something? Because they were, as we would say, the boots on the ground. They were there. They saw it. They know what is happening. They should have the best idea of how to approach this situation because they were there and they saw it. But they were going by human reasoning instead of what God had told them to do. And so human reasoning can be more influential than godly leaders. There's another part of human reasoning that comes in sometimes, and I believe that is personal interpretation. And often if you can reason something out, then you can feel like it is the way it should be. And so we have sometimes personal interpretation versus group voice and how the two work together and how they can mesh or how they can drive people up and groups apart. And I'm not sure exactly what to say on all that because as we'll look at a little bit later, that group voice can be a problem as well when it is influenced the wrong way. And so, but often human reasoning, one man or one person will get up on their pedestal and make a point because this is how they view it and how they see it. And it can be more influential sometimes in godly leaders. All right, second thing I'd like to consider is emotional appeal. Emotional appeal can be more influential than godly leaders. So first they began with facts, and they gave some human reasoning, but it wasn't long until it appears like they went off the facts and started appealing to some of the emotions of the people. They said that when we saw the giants, we felt like grasshoppers. Fact or emotional appeal? Probably some emotional appeal. And we looked like grasshoppers to them. I don't think they knew that. But yet that played on their emotions because, you know, if those people thought we were grasshoppers, surely we don't stand a chance. They could just step on us and we'd squish like a bug and we'd be gone. And then they start, then they say that it would be better if we had just died in Egypt as slaves rather than starve in this barren wilderness. Well, that starts to play on your emotions as well. Certainly, it'd be better to be in Egypt with some food, even if you had to work hard, than to die out here by starvation. And then they talked about the injustice of God. God brought us out of Egypt only to die while our wives and our children are taken for plunder. They thought that when the Canaanites overcome them, they're going to kill the men, take the wives and children for plunder. And what an injustice that was. You know, God brought us out here just for that to happen. And they were building a case that was appealing to the emotions of the group. No longer looking at facts. The fact of the matter was not that their life in Egypt was great. The fact of the matter was not that God brought them out just to destroy them. It was their own choices that were bringing this destruction upon them. That was not the facts. The fact of the matter was not that they were grasshoppers next to these people. That wasn't the fact, but it was a story that was fabricated that appealed to the emotions. They had an unfair advantage. Certainly, we wouldn't want to go in and try and fight with an unfair advantage. We needed some pity. We had some injustice from God. You know, today in our world, there is a thing called marketing, and it's not new. It's been around for a long time. People discovered years ago that you can market things to sell, to make things happen. You can convince people that they need to buy things, that they need something. They appeal to the emotions largely, not always, but largely. And you've heard the saying, I'm sure, that we convince people to buy things they do not need to, with money they do not have, to impress people that they do not like. And that's what marketing does often. Not that marketing is all wrong and all bad. You know, we do sell things, but marketing plays on the emotions. And in today's world, it's not only products, but there's also ideology that is marketed out there. There's a lot of marketing that goes into the political world. And when you think about elections, and they hire people, they have people on their teams to help market the politician to the public in a way that hopefully convinces them to vote for him. And you see, so often what is marketed is not really the reality, is not truth, is not really how it is. But yet you're convinced to buy something or to agree to something or to accept something because of a good marketing plan, a good marketing package. And that's when that is what emotional appeal does. And too many times emotional appeal can be more influential than a godly leader. And the third thing that I have here is that mass participation can be more influential than godly leaders. And I'm not sure if that's the right word, and if you have a better word for me, I'd be open to it. But just the idea that when the whole crowd, when everybody else is doing it, I can't talk and spell at the same time. I think I got it up there now. All right, when the whole crowd is doing it, everybody else is doing it, and so why not? And so we don't look at what is the truth about the matter. We look at what everybody else is doing. How is it working for everybody else? They're doing it, and it seems to be working for them. If you, back to this story of the children of Israel, if there was in this multitude people that were on the fence, and most likely there were in this group of millions of people, they heard the 10 spies and what they had to say. They heard Moses and Aaron and Joshua and Caleb and their point, and maybe they were on the fence a bit. But you know, as that whole thing shifted and as the crowd entered into this euphoria or crowd spirit or mob spirit, all of a sudden, if you didn't agree with them, you were wrong. You were not right, because everybody else agrees with it and everybody else feels this way. And you have this mass participation that all of a sudden becomes more influential than a godly leader and what God wants. At this point, the influence in the group was already widespread. No longer was it just 10 men influencing the millions. Rather, the masses had joined in this movement, and together they were in collusion against the truth and those that stood by it. And so you had this mob spirit, and along with it came some power. Crowds have power, and you know, even the law, the officers of the land, the police, they don't know what to do with that when there's huge crowds with a mob spirit. They don't know how to control that. There's a power that is there. There's a control there that big group has over the people that should be in control. And often in those big groups, there is no clear leadership. There is no clear direction. They sometimes don't even know what the cause or what they're trying to accomplish, because they don't have any clear leadership, but rather it is just a force, a group force. It is mass participation. The euphoria of the crowd just moves the masses along. And in the story of the children of Israel, at this point, the glory of the Lord, well, it says that they spoke of stoning Joshua and Caleb. They wanted to get rid of the voices of truth that were there, the voices of opposition, the resistance. They had no time for them. And it seems like at that point, the glory of the Lord showed up at the tabernacle. But that didn't even have an effect on them. They were so deluded. They were in delusion at this point through their unbelief and through what they had accepted as the truth, that they could not see through their delusion, past their delusion. And when the glory of the Lord showed up at the tabernacle, you would think that it would catch their attention and cause them to stop. But no, they weren't paying attention anymore. They had been influenced away from God. Well, Satan, I believe, used these same tactics or similar tactics in the Garden of Eden. If you think about his approach with Eve, he came with human reasoning. He got her, wanted her to start thinking from a human perspective. He said, "Did God say you shouldn't eat of all the fruit in the garden? Is that really what God said? Well, what's the reason for that? Why would you not be allowed to eat from one of the trees? Why would God withhold something good from you?" Begins down the trail of human reasoning. It wasn't long until there was an emotional appeal. When she looked at that, and it said it was beautiful to look on, and it looked desirous to eat. It looked like a good piece of fruit. In fact, all of a sudden, it looked better than any other fruit in the garden. And it had that appeal to her emotions. And besides all that, there was a benefit not only for the food value, but also the benefit of becoming wise, whatever that means, enlightening. And this appealed to her emotions. And finally, after she partook of the fruit, well, then she was no longer happy to not get others involved. And there became mass participation, if it was mass. I mean, it was the entire human race, so I guess it was mass participation at that point. But there was, you know, only one other person. But everybody, all the human race became involved. There was definitely collusion. When we oppose ourselves, or when people oppose themselves, as Paul talked to Timothy, he referenced those who walked away from the truth, and he said that they oppose themselves. When we oppose ourselves, we will endeavor to take others with us, just like Eve took Adam along, and just like the 10 spies and the group of people took that whole crowd, the whole community along with them. So as we think about that, who is influencing us today? What voices are we listening to? Are there voices that are creeping in unawares? Is there, you know, it could be, of course, in Jude's time, I believe there was actually people there that were teaching false doctrine. And I'm not suggesting that we have people here in our congregation that are teaching false doctrine. But are there other ways that influences could be creeping in? Well, I think we all know that there are ways that it can creep in, and maybe even unawares. There's media, which comes to us in many forms and is easy to get. We can listen to things with ease. We can read the news. We can watch the news. We can listen to the news and podcasts. And there's many books out there. And you can start reading some of them, and they sound really good. It makes a lot of sense. It aligns with the way humans think. That's why they can sell the books, right? Because people can understand what they're saying. And I'm not saying that makes them all wrong, but we need to be careful, and we need to think about that. Are there voices that are influencing us more than God and His Word and the godly leaders that God has put in place to give us direction? Which voices are the loudest in our lives? Is it God and His Word and the church? Those things that God, the way that God would like to speak into our lives? Or is it other things? There are tragic results of following the wrong voices. If you look at the account of the Israelites, they missed entering the promised land. They were there. They were almost ready to enter. They missed it. They missed it. They missed the rest that was promised. They were going to have a land where they could rest. They wouldn't have to wander anymore. They would have a home. But they missed it. Tragic result of following the wrong voice. You know, there's something else that happened, and I don't know that I ever thought about this before, but Moses missed out on the promised land as well. And you have to wonder how it actually would have gone had they entered right then when they were there. Because the account where Moses struck the rock happened following this time. It happened during the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Well, I don't know. I mean, it was all in God's plan and God's timing. God knew what would happen, but you know, would Moses have entered the promised land if it wouldn't have been for the group that listened to the influences of the 10 spies that day when they came back? I don't know. It's a sobering thought to think about. A man, a man like Moses, and I'm not saying that he lost out in his faith, but a tragic result of a group listening to the wrong voice could be that a strong man could lose out on his faith as well and not enter into the promised land. Not enter into rest. You know, we have a goal of a promised land as well. And if we listen to the wrong voices, we will miss the goal. We will be influenced into delusion. And as we look at our Sunday school lessons in the book of Revelation, as we get nearer the end of the book, and it talks about the delusion that is there, and as I'm sure we are approaching the end times, we are certainly closer than we ever were before. And there will be widespread delusion and widespread acceptance of that which is not true. And it behooves us to make sure that we are listening to the right voices and are not influenced away from God. Let's kneel for prayer.